This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Canoy. And this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Among many other bills, the New Hampshire Senate voted yesterday on a bill that would repeal a law that currently allows buffer zones around abortion clinics. Senator Susie of Manchester defended the law, citing an increase in protests and violence at reproductive health centers in the past few years.
We've seen an increase in violent rhetoric and actions directed at health care centers, including most recently a very tragic shooting in Colorado, and devastating vandalism to a health care center in our own Claremont, New Hampshire.
Meanwhile, more scrutiny at Manchester's Valley Street Jail, with the State Board of Medicine suspending the license of Dr. Matthew Mazowick, the doctor in charge of medical care at the jail. Attorney Larry Vogelman, who's representing three former inmates, said he's received at least six letters a week from New Hampshire inmates.
I get more complaints about medical care in Valley Street than the prisons and all the other jails together, probably threefold.
And spring in New Hampshire means tucking your pants into your boots to avoid ticks, says Granite Geek David Brooks.
So basically, the best prevention is to not get the tick to bite you in the first place. And you want to go outside because it's gorgeous. What's the point of living in New Hampshire if you don't go outside? So you got to take some various remedies.
Today on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two reporters joining me for the full hour this morning. With me is Jeff Feingold. Jeff is editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Dean.
And Trent Spinner. Trent is executive editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Trent, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Gentlemen, there's a lot to talk about, as always. But let's start where we often do on Fridays, which is with the ongoing opioid crisis in New Hampshire. There were a number of developments on different fronts over the past week, so let's start there. Jeff, let me turn to you first. We've heard some updated numbers on overdose deaths for the first 4 months of 2016. Not especially encouraging news. What did we learn?
No, it's just the same. Seems it's like the same trend that's been happening for the last couple of years, and disturbing numbers. I guess through the end of April, there were 82 fatalities confirmed to drug overdoses, and much of that was involving opioids like fentanyl. Heroin wasn't as serious a problem. There's only about four or so of those fatalities involved heroin, and there were some other drugs as well. But for the most part, they were prescription opioids, and I think that really does shine a light on what the situation we are facing in New Hampshire and apparently elsewhere around the country.
Right. So Trent, we have these initial 82 deaths already. I read that there are another 72 awaiting toxicology tests, so we may be already up over 150. So it sounds kind of like we're on track to either match or eclipse the total number. Last year was something about 437 or 438. Jeff mentioned fentanyl. This seems to be the real wild card this time.
Sure. It's a much more powerful – it's sort of like the ugly cousin of heroin. And it's easy to get on the streets right now. It's incredibly powerful. And the problem is for all of these drugs, especially on the street, you don't know what kind of dose you're getting. And so people are taking, you know, some fentanyl and they think that, you know, that they'll get a certain level of high, but They really have no way of knowing how powerful it is, if there's anything else in that drug. And so it's incredibly dangerous. We hear, you know, we have a scanner in the newsroom. And I remember maybe a year ago, a year and a half ago, you'd hear maybe one overdose call on the scanner a day. Now, if you're this is in Manchester, you know, it's maybe once an hour, once every few hours. And so you can really see what an uptick we've seen. And it doesn't seem like it's slowing down.
And the thing about this is that this is statewide. This is not just something that's concentrated in the cities like Manchester and Dover's having serious issues, but this is all over the state.
Yeah, and for people who are not aware, fentanyl, I think, is an opioid. It's a painkiller. I've heard people take it for back surgery and injuries and workplace injuries and things like that. It's highly addictive. And Trent, you mentioned that people don't know how much they're getting. It sounds like some people aren't even aware that it's being mixed in at all, that they're basically taking it and being unaware that there's fentanyl with it mixed in with the heroin.
That's right, and that's what makes it so dangerous, is that people don't know what they're getting on the street.
Yeah. So let's take a little bit of a step back and talk about some of the developments this week, specifically targeting addiction and the opioid crisis. And Jeff, let me turn to you. A new private recovery center opening in the south end of Concord.
Yes.
And then also discussion, we can talk about the possibility of opening up one in a former state facility in Laconia.
In Laconia, yeah. This is first of all, the organization Hope for New Hampshire Recovery has been very active in trying to get these recovery centers opened up. One is opened up in Manchester a while ago at the former Hoyts Furniture.
Right, they got a lot of press.
They have one in Newport. Now they're opening up one in Concord. Apparently there's discussions to open them up in other places like Keene and elsewhere. This is obviously a response to this growing crisis. As for the Laconia State School one, that's an interesting one because Laconia State School, the former state school, has been it's just been sitting there for many years since it was closed by court order back in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's this big campus that they've been trying to find a use for. They've used it as a prison or jail or what. You know, they've tried different uses for it. And this is the latest example of trying to use at least one or two of the buildings for recovery efforts, treatment efforts. It's the state trying to figure out what it can do. As we'll probably discuss in a little while, you know, the states in the legislature, they've been trying very hard to come up with some kind of response. But
right.
The state's resources are not exactly as robust as maybe is needed to address this, you know, just so thoroughly.
Right. And Trent, the one in Concord, I'm a Concord resident, so I've sort of read about what's going on there. Not actually a place where people will be treated, but a place where you can go during sort of extended business hours, which I think was one of the constraints put on it by the planning board, to be connected with resources. And that seems to be a trend around the state.
That is a trend around the state. And the Manchester Fire Department is also jumping into
this. A new item announced by Mayor Gatsis recently.
That's right. This week, Mayor Gatsis and the Manchester Fire Department announced that if you are having an issue with opioid addiction, you can go to any city fire department, and they will connect you with resources. They say that they've been seeing a lot of people just showing up at the fire department, and they weren't exactly sure what to do. You know, obviously the fire departments have Narcan.
Yeah, EMTs and ambulances, et cetera. Yeah.
Sure, sure. And so they, you know, people were turning up when they were having an issue. And so now what they're doing is they put a program in place where if you show up at a Manchester Fire Department building, they will get you to the services that you need
Yeah, I wasn't aware of this personally, but I think there are 10 fire departments that are 24 hours in Manchester. This is a pretty big commitment, Jeff.
Yeah.
Do you think that this is sort of the next logical step, or is this more of an experiment?
I think they're trying to figure out what they can do that will work. As you know, as Trent was saying, you know, about earlier off the air about the number of calls he's heard on the scanners. You know, just this huge spike in overdoses is something that they have to do. I mean, they have to handle. I just have to say one other thing. Last night, I had this opportunity to attend a preview of a film, beginning of a film on this program involving Dartmouth students and female inmates at the Sullivan County Jail in Unity. And there was a panel discussion afterwards, including two of the inmates. And they both mentioned how they went through this program at the jail that sounds pretty remarkable. It's a year-long program, and they both had addiction problems. And now one of them is working as a supervisor at a manufacturing company. Another one has her own business. But the point that was driven home was that this just isn't. This is just one little program, and it's not what not everybody who's eligible can be in it, and it's not the same. It's not available in all the other jails. And one of the really ironic things one of them said was, you know, there's more treatment availability for if I had gone to prison and committed a really really terrible crime, because there's really nothing done at the county jail level really. And I think that that's something that we might as a state need to look at. You know, why are we not providing services to people? Because a lot, if not most or a very large proportion of the people who are in county jails are there on drug crimes. Mm. And shouldn't that be one of the places where they're really addressing this problem?
Right. And Trent, so this raises one or two larger questions that I think we can kind of tie everything together here. You know, the first is whether or not, you know, we just saw these statistics that show that there's a spike, and perhaps it's the case that the new programs that are kicking in just need more time. But, you know, we have this new center in Concord. Jeff mentioned the one in Manchester. You've mentioned the firehouses, and perhaps we'll get one in Laconia if they can work that out. There's a trade-off here, though, between kind of first responders, law enforcement, and addiction treatment and recovery that we've talked about on the Roundup extensively. Say a little bit more about how that trade-off, how they're trying to balance those concerns.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen since we started talking about this, I'd say a year and a half ago, what we've seen is that a lot of the programs that people were hoping to get going are now up and running, and there's been some success. People have seen, you know, people who go to treatment, we're seeing a lower recidivism rate for people who were addicted to heroin or opioids and are now no longer addicted. And so, you know, everyone's trying to balance, do we prosecute these people? Do we make sure they get into treatment? How much money do we spend? And so what we've seen is all of those efforts sort of really they're up and running now, and we're kind of at that point where everyone's hoping that we'll see the numbers start to go down.
You expect it at some point to go down if they're treating it sufficiently.
Right? That's the hope, is that right now we're sort of at the cusp of that point where these numbers are going to start going down every month. We haven't seen it yet, but everyone kind of has their fingers crossed that this is the point where we might start mm-hmm. to see some progress.
Yeah, and Jeff, one final item on this that kind of ties in with what Trent was saying. There's been discussion in the state legislature about needle exchanges and decriminalizing trace amounts of drugs in these needles. The Senate kind of took action the other day. It looks like we're headed for a commission.
Yeah, it does seem like that. I think it's still a troublesome idea for some members of the legislature.
But this speaks to the issue of enforcement and you know, are you letting people off who should be prosecuted?
Yeah, exactly, and that's one of these things they're juggling this. But I think at this point, as you can see by just the idea that they're opening up, let's say, firehouses in Manchester and things like that. I mean, I think for the most part, if the idea is that we want to get these people into treatment and get to recovery, that's the way to do it, as opposed to, as I said earlier, arresting them and putting them in jail and apparently not getting very many services.
Yeah, Trent.
The needle exchange was a tricky one because that would sort of decriminalize very small amounts of opioids, and it would allow – it would set up an exchange where if you had a dirty needle, you could get a clean one, and police were against it. They said that, you know, it takes an important tool off their off their table, right? If they find someone with a needle, they can arrest that person and then hopefully get them into some sort of treatment program. If this were to become law – they wouldn't be able to do that anymore. And so, you know, they asked the House and the Senate to study this more.
So we're going to get a commission and they'll give some suggestions for how you might pursue this or have an appropriate, acceptable trade-off in the future. I want to let our listeners know this is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. I have two guests today for the hour, Jeff Feingold, he's editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, and Trent Spinner, executive editor of the Union Leader. And gentlemen, let's turn to another kind of medical story. Medical marijuana. We've been talking about this on the Roundup literally for years at this point. Finally, Jeff Feingold, getting some movement on opening up these exchanges. Dispensaries. What's the latest?
Well, what's happening, as you know, the bill to allow the sale of medical marijuana it's been a couple of years old now, and it took the state quite a while to come up with rules. And in that time, there's been a lot of demand for this because of as we said, you know, as actually it does tie into this previous discussion, because instead of using perhaps opioids as painkillers, you know, people arguing, well, medical marijuana might be the better way to go to relieve a lot of pain, because apparently some people are turning to had been turning to these things, opioids and stuff, to help alleviate their pain. Mm-hmm. But anyway, finally, one opened in Plymouth.
Yep.
And then another one's opening in Dover, and there are a couple
two more to go.
And there's two more to go. And apparently, the one in Plymouth, when it opened, there were so many people there. But I guess if you're registered to get the marijuana, you have to be registered at that specific
dispensary. Yeah.
And so there's a little confusion about the rules. But I assume once they're all open, it will be working the way it's supposed to be working. We obviously don't know. It just started. But right. This is something that people have been fighting for many, many years in New Hampshire, is allowing medical marijuana. We're not even talking about, decriminalization or legalization. that's another whole issue. But in terms of allowing medical marijuana, this is a big step.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. Yeah, Trent?
Yeah, we sent a reporter to cover the first facility that opened in Plymouth over the weekend. That was on Saturday. And we were just really interested. We asked him to do a story that sort of just looked at who's there. Who are these people who are at this dispensary, who have gone through the whole process of getting this card that they need through the state to be able to purchase. And he laid it out, the story he laid it out, it was a lot of people who with chronic pain, people who were using canes and walkers, people who were really sick. Yeah. And this was sort of their last option here. And they had nowhere else to turn, and so they wanted to try this. And then he also kind of described what the facility was like. Mm-hmm. He wasn't allowed to go inside because he didn't have that card that you need. And what was interesting was that even, there was a husband who was there. He didn't have his card, but his wife had the card. He wasn't allowed to even go inside the facility because he didn't have the necessary paperwork. So it is, it's not open to the public.
Right.
You have to have this card from Health and Human Services that will allow you to get in. And then all of the packaging, it was packaged like medicine. It was in, pill bottles, and it was in, packages that didn't have – there were no images of marijuana leaves or anything like that. I mean, this was all – it looked like medicine.
Yeah. Jeff, so we have these two that are open. We got two more coming in Merrimack and Lebanon, and they're supposed to be open in the next few months. But these are very tightly controlled, and I'm interested to see whether there's going to be pressure to expand the range of acceptable conditions that allow you to get this marijuana. It's a very small list now.
Yeah, there has been pressure to do things like for PTSD and other conditions, and I think that will be the next wave of this. We'll be trying to expand the conditions, because as Trent was describing what the reporter saw there, that those are the people who came to testify for this bill over the years, and they're finally getting some relief. But there are other people who had been testifying who are not going to be haven't seen that relief yet, and I think there'll be pressure, especially if this is working the way it sounds like it's going to work. It's really just like going to a pharmacy, but a very, very controlled pharmacy. So this could happen that there might be some pressure to expand the conditions.
So we're obviously going to be watching these open up in the coming months. Trent, one final story before we take a quick break. It sounds like the attempt to repeal the buffer zone around facilities providing abortions went down to defeat in the center, Senate.
The never enforced buffer zones.
Right.
Yes. This is a debate that's going on for a long time about there was an attempt to set up a certain amount of space outside of
25 feet
around clinics that provide abortions. And it's never been enforced. It appears that, there's a question about whether or not it's even legal. There was a Supreme Court ruling about a similar law in Massachusetts. And, it went down this week. And the question is, what happens next?
Jeff, any quick thoughts?
Yeah, I just think it's something, as Trent said, it's something that's been coming up. It's becoming almost like a Martin Luther King Day bill for the older people who remember what I'm talking about. It just comes up every year.
Yeah, so we have the 25-foot buffer. It's not being enforced. I think they're watching Massachusetts to see what happens with the legal issues with their 35-foot buffer. But it is on the books, and as I mentioned, the Senate was unable to repeal that buffer in a 12-12 split vote. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back, and we're going to turn our attention to politics here in New Hampshire. We now have a somewhat presumptive Republican nominee in Donald Trump, so we're going to talk all about what that means for New Hampshire. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and we want you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page. You can also find us on Twitter. And I have two guests joining me for the hour. I have Trent Spinner, executive editor for The Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News, and Jeff Feingold, the editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Gentlemen, let's go to the phones. We have a couple folks calling in. We have a caller joining us from Manchester. Welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, hi. I have a couple of different issues that I've run into. One of them is trying to find the residential programs in the state. When one does a Google search for residential programs, drug programs in New Hampshire, there comes up a myriad of lists, and many of them will direct you to locations outside the state. So first of all, finding the locations is very difficult. And then second of all, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of long-term or even short-term residential programs. I'm glad to hear that there are new programs that are going to be opening up all over the state. You said Laconia and Manchester and maybe in Keene. I think there's a real need for the residential programs. But then the last thing is the ability for patients or clients to be able to sign themselves in and out of a program. So if a client, generally speaking, is over 18, which they are, they can sign themselves out if they're uncomfortable, if they don't want to be there. And, you know, after being in there for a week of a 28-day program, if they just walk away because they can, that is really difficult in keeping them in a treatment facility. And I've, you know, found that there, one in particular that I won't name, does seem to have quite a revolving door. Mm-hmm. It is in Manchester, but,
yes.
You know, I've heard of it. I know of it. I know that the beds.
So
open
Let me jump in here and ask Trent your general reaction. We were talking about this before the break. That half the battle from the callers. Comments is about just sort of information and finding the resources.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, in some of our original reporting on this, and I think the caller was right, that it was very difficult to find a bed, to find space if you had a family member, a loved one who was struggling with opioid addiction, and you tried to find that person a space in a treatment facility, it was incredibly difficult to do that. And that's what a lot of this push has been, is to open up more beds, right? More beds and more facilities and more places throughout the state. And that's what a lot of folks have been doing. This specific caller, you know, I recommend trying that, the Manchester Fire Department. We haven't, you know, when we've had a reporter who's kind of tried to go through, you know, the state has done a lot to try and make it easier to find treatment for opioid addiction. And so we've had a reporter who's tried all kinds of different things to see, you know, just how easy is it. We haven't gone to the Manchester Fire Department yet to see what kind of services they're able to do. But, you know, that's one thing that I'd recommend.
Yeah, it seems like they're still trying to figure things out, and we'll see how it develops over in the coming months. Thanks to our Manchester caller for those comments. Let's go back to the phones for one more call. We have Richard joining us from Auburn. Richard, welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
In regards to the medical marijuana and for PTSD use, myself being a 100% disabled combat veteran, and in the early to mid-90s, getting treatment from the VA and being issued pharmaceuticals to help relieve my PTSD symptoms and as well chronic pain issues, just unmanageable to run a normal living healthy lifestyle, and years of switching pharmaceutical drugs and never being able to actually just pull myself together, with a moderate use of some medical marijuana, or maybe not even medical marijuana, because back in the day there wasn't anything available as that form, having to buy it off the streets. I would very I find it hard to believe that that wasn't taken into consideration and was refused through the New Hampshire Congress.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard, thank you for that call, your own personal testimony there. This is one of those debates I think that's going to be going on for a while in terms of what conditions are entitled to using the medical marijuana. But we've heard from a number of vets in recent months about how this may offer them some hope. And we'll continue to follow this story in the coming weeks. Gentlemen, a lot of other stuff to get to. So let's turn our attention now to electoral politics. We have a presumptive nominee on the Republican side in Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton looking to be in reasonably good shape, although the Bernie Sanders campaign is going to continue on for now. Donald Trump had a solid victory here in February in our primary, 35%. I saw some polling data in recent weeks that suggest maybe a little bit of buyer's remorse, but nonetheless, he seems to be consolidating his nomination. Let me ask you both, your sense of the general reaction among Republicans in the state. And Jeff, let me start with you, and then I'll go to Trent.
I think that they're trying to come to grips with the idea of Donald Trump as the presidential nominee. I think it's basically reflecting what's going on nationally. The Republican Party is at a certain point now where I think they had been in the denial stage, and now they're heading towards acceptance on the idea that Donald Trump is going to be their candidate. You see nationally where Speaker Ryan has even said that he's not ready to endorse him, and you've had other people like former House Speaker Bill O'Brien saying he's not going to support Donald Trump. And those are people from two different, basically different segments of the Republican Party. Senator Ayotte has, however, said she's going to support him but not endorse him, although that's kind of a word that just doesn't really
I couldn't figure about that.
But the Republican Party really is doing what's happening nationally. They're trying to lie. I think there's a number of them who's trying to accept the idea of Donald Trump being the candidate. But there are still many who are still resistant to just the idea of him being the nominee. And I also think in terms of just having him on the ticket in New Hampshire specifically, that could be some problematic for some of the candidates down the ballot, especially as you're talking about his numbers in. Mm-hmm. In New Hampshire polls.
Yeah, I saw a recent poll suggested that if people could vote again, they would have voted for Kasich.
Yeah.
That may change again now.
I think.
But it's interesting to see
that's of what's
right,
going on.
Right.
But I think he has a really tough hill to climb.
Sure.
In New Hampshire, specifically, but elsewhere around the country, apparently, judging by even some of his more recent actions.
Yeah. Trent?
I would call it infighting. I think that there's serious turmoil inside the Republican Party. I think that if you talk to Republicans, they say, you know, I'm not sure I can vote for him. You know, you talk to a lot of Republicans and they say that. Look, this is New Hampshire, right? And so all of these people, right, who are political operatives, who are big-time donors, they've spent time with all these other candidates. They spent time with Kasich and Cruz and Jeb Bush. And so they have a personal connection to a lot of their candidates. And what you've seen is none of those candidates are really coming out to support Trump yet. And so a lot of their supporters are also not coming out to support Trump yet.
Yeah, I saw a statistic that almost all of the state senators who are Republicans endorsed other candidates. There are no real sort of hardcore Trump supporters.
Yeah, and if you want to just mention nationally, once again, I saw a list of some of the leading Republicans who are not yet endorsing Trump or even say they're not going to support him. And two of them stood out to me. One of them was a congressman from Texas named Louie Gohmert, who's very, very conservative. And he says he doesn't want to support Trump because he needs to apologize to Ted Cruz for all the horrible things he said about him. And I assume that maybe Mr. Trump will come around on that one. And another one was Steve King, who's also a very, very, very conservative congressman from Iowa, who also says he's not ready to support Trump. So this is really just reflective of there's people to the more moderate members
these
of
are
the
tea
Republican
party,
party.
Guys,
these are real, these are hardcore Tea Party guys, as former Speaker O'Brien is.
Yeah.
And they're
and
also
he is
not
someone
ready.
Who was not, right? Speaker O'Brien has said he's not thrilled about this either.
Former Speaker
O'Brien.
He was a Cruz supporter,
yes. Right.
And if you look at how the candidate Trump has treated Ted Cruz in particular, what he was saying about him, that is, I think that his Cruz's supporters, to say they have their nose out of joint is probably a little it's mild compared to some of the things he was saying about him.
But Trent, I saw – I think Scott Brown was very happy about Trump being the nominee. Didn't Scott Brown when he ran against Jean Shaheen, and now he's actually someone who seems to be supporting him.
He had endorsed him earlier,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, Scott Brown has always been with Trump. But I think Paul Ryan, the U.S. House Speaker, wrapped it up pretty nicely yesterday. He was on CNN. He was talking about what it's going to take for Donald Trump to sort of bring the party together. And he said, look, there are lots of different wings in the party, and you spent a lot of time bashing the establishment. But we want to see you essentially say, here are my conservative principles, and here's why you should vote for me. And I think that what we're seeing here in New Hampshire is also playing out on the national level, where people are saying Trump needs to figure out a way. You've spent a lot of time kind of bashing all kinds of different parts of the party. Now that you're the presumptive nominee, your job is to bring us all together. And the question is, can he do that?
Yeah, can he roll it back? Yeah.
So what does your gut tell you about whether or not Trump understands how much work he needs to do?
And that's the thing. I think there's a lot of work to be done, and not just in New Hampshire. I mean, we talked to almost a dozen Republican operatives. I mean, establishment, free state, all kinds of, sort of spanning the entire Republican Party. And you'll see that most of them are not on the Trump train yet. And there's a lot of work to be done nationally, but then you have to go. I mean, that's part of what makes a really good campaign is the ability to identify key supporters and be able to go to send someone to them and say, hey, look, here's why you need to vote for my candidate, for this candidate. And the question is whether the Trump campaign can do that. They don't have a lot of people on the ground here. And so are they going to spend that time going door to door, right? Operative to operative, talking to them about why it's important for them to not only vote for Trump, but also help get their message out.
It's in a way, it's like running the New Hampshire primary campaign that they didn't run.
Right.
Which, because, that was just, he was just, helicopter in, do his big rallies and leave.
Right.
And there really wasn't any kind of a real campaign, a formal New Hampshire primary campaign. And now he's going to have to come up with one because if anything, Senator Clinton certainly knows Secretary Clinton certainly knows how to run a campaign in New Hampshire.
Or then the other option is you just don't. And that's kind of what Trump did with the New Hampshire primary. You don't bother with all these people and these supporters. You just come in and you hope that the popular vote carries you across the line. And it worked for him in February. And the question is, can he do that again in New Hampshire?
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm joined in studio by Jeff Feingold of the New Hampshire Business Review and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. And let's talk a little bit about Jennifer Horne and the state party. She is someone who has been very critical of Donald Trump in the past. She now has to deal with him as the potential nominee. And Trent, let me turn to you. There was this kind of kerfuffle about a mail-in ballot to choose state delegates to the various committees at the convention. On top of that, I also read that Corey Lewandowski may end up being the chair of the delegation. This is Donald Trump's campaign manager. So what do you know about this mail ballot issue?
So parties all across the country, what they need to do is they need to select their delegates who go – these are the people who you see cheering on – we watch on TV. These are the people who are cheering on the House floor, and these are the folks who would stand underneath the New Hampshire banner, and they would be they would be our representatives there. And so there was a vote, and it was going to be by email about who these people should be. Trump supporters were very unhappy because it didn't include
I don't think there was anybody on there.
Right. It didn't include any of their delegates to any of the key committees. But that kind of goes to what Jeff and I were just talking about, that, is Trump – that's something that a campaign would have known about. That's a rule – that rule has been established for a long time. And that's something that once you win the primary, you'd say, okay, I'm going to work with the party to make sure that my delegates are going to Cleveland. That's something the Trump campaign didn't do. When they realized the vote was happening, it was over the weekend last weekend, they made us think about it. And the chairman, Jennifer Horne, said, we're not going to do this vote anymore. We'll do it in person this week. And their delegates – are now part of the they will now be going to Cleveland, including Corey Lewandowski, who's from Wyndham and will be leading the delegation.
Yeah, let's go to Jeff. One second.
This has been playing itself out in other states also, where before Senator Cruz dropped out, he had been gathering up delegates pledged to him on a later ballot. And, the Trump people were just caught off guard by not being prepared for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they do seem that they are caught off guard with these sorts of delegate rules. Gentlemen, let's go to the phones. I got some people calling in here. Corrine from Hampton, welcome to the exchange.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Can you hear?
Yes.
Yes. Can you hear me?
You sound good.
Okay.
So my comments are about the state Republican Party that never really got their act together in the first place because there were 17 candidates. We usually have people on the seacoast that have huge signs in their front yard supporting the candidates. They have, you know, rallies at their homes. And that didn't happen this year. And it seemed like it took till a couple of days before the primary where somebody really started putting up their signs and realizing that, uh-oh, we better get together on this. And somebody in the Republican, I'm not a Republican, but somebody should have, you know, gotten the people together and warned them. But once Trump had the union leader removed from covering that debate in Manchester at St. Anselm's, right in their home city, that should have been a huge clue that, you know, this guy's serious.
That was a surprise to us, yes, I'll tell you that. That was
Corrine, we have the executive editor of the union leader here, so let's get his response. Thank you for that call.
That was a difficult weekend. You know, that was it was a Saturday. Donald Trump tweeted, ABC News should remove the union leader from upcoming debate. And, you know, we saw it and we said, there's no way that could happen. And then Sunday we got a call from the, you know, vice president of ABC News who said, you know, we're concerned about what this is going to look like. So we're sad to say, but we have to remove you from the debate. And, you know, removing the union leader from a Republican debate just before the primary in Manchester was something that we just – it was shocking to us.
Unprecedented is the word.
Unprecedented.
I'd have to say, though, that
go ahead, Jeff.
It is a reflection of how the media in general nationally has been I guess I'm going to use the word complicit in the rise of Donald Trump, you know, giving, you know, over a billion, close to $2 billion in free unpaid media. And that's, you know, it's really helped fuel it. And this is, you know, this is, we're paying for, we're not, I shouldn't do it, but we are seeing the results right now.
Trent, before we go to a break, one more political story we need to touch on. First congressional district, the Republican race, the incumbent Frank Ginta running for re-election. We've now had yet another candidate drop out. We were at four, now we're down to just two. What happened there?
This is my favorite race, and it's kind of happening under the radar here. Not many people are paying attention to it, but I am, because this is a fascinating race. What happened this week was that Republican Pam Tucker dropped out of the race. Dan Innes, who was the former dean of the UNH Business School, also dropped out of the race earlier last month. And so now we have Bedford businessman Rich Ashew running against incumbent Frank Ginta. And it's a head-to-head race. Frank Ginta has been primaried before. He's been in primaries before. And he's won very narrowly. But he's never been in a primary with just one other person.
I've heard people say the head-to-head is a problem for him. Is that true?
The head-to-head is an incredible problem for him. I think he has a lot of headwind here. There was a recent poll that showed only 4% of people would vote for him. 4%.
Yeah, it's really – he has – talk about having a tough hill to climb. Even just in terms of raising money, he's having major problems. And Rich Ashew has not been having that many problems because he has apparently some people putting up a super PAC for him, is it? And some national Republicans backing him. And I think that
– he's someone who's been around.
He's been around. He's run before. He's popular. And actually I've talked to even people who – are basically Ginta supporters who say, "Well, Rich isn't such a bad guy." I mean, I just think that the support for the congressman is not very robust. Let's put it that way.
We haven't seen fundraising numbers for Ashew yet because he just announced.
But I would not be surprised if it's pretty impressive, even for someone coming in this late.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gentlemen, we have to take one final break. But coming up, we got lots more to talk about. Maybe a little more politics, more developments at the State House and around the state. So stick with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and this is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. You can still call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. I have two guests with me today, Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. And gentlemen, our political discussion in the last segment has gotten a lot of interest, so let's go back to the phones. We have Gary calling in from Nashua. Gary, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I appreciate that. My comment is that all these senators and representatives who are currently elected by the Republican Party and sitting, and obviously they're speaking out against, you know, they can't support Trump, they can't do this for Trump, they can't. That feels to me like it's very a personal opinion, because they were elected by the same people that are now voting for Trump. So they should be supporting this electric people that are doing the voting. So their I guess, duty should be to support Trump, because it's the same people that put them in office.
Jeff, your reaction?
I think what it is, in, especially if you're talking about New Hampshire, you know, Mr. Trump got about, what is it, about 35% of the vote. So I don't know if it's true that all these same people voted for Trump, put all these people in office, but they are part of the party. They're party officials. And there is an argument to be made that, and that's being made, that they, people should line up behind him because he is the candidate. But as Trent and I were talking about, you know, he hasn't really built bridges to a lot of these people. And I think in the end, we're seeing the results of that. It's not something that it's not the common way a political campaign is run. And if you have no relations with someone and all of a sudden you expect them to endorse you immediately, I think that's probably asking a bit much.
And the other thing you have to consider is that there are very well-known Republicans, high-ranking Republicans, who disagree with Donald Trump. They disagree with him on a number of issues. And if you look at New Hampshire, right, if you looked at exit polls coming out of New Hampshire, more people support a pathway to citizenship than building a wall. And so there are Republicans who disagree with him on a number of issues.
On the basic, his basic issues.
Yeah. And so they say – and these are, you know, people like Jennifer Horne, Kelly Ayotte. And they say, I don't have – just because he's the nominee, I don't have to endorse him.
Gary, thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones one more time. We have Don joining us from Rochester. Don, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi. My question is this, or a comment, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to communicate it right, but I'll try. If we have a lower voter turnout than Trump is the apparent Republican candidate, and the lower – voter turnout of Republicans, meaning less Trump voters, and then you have a majority of the traditional, more Republican voters coming in, and thus either Kasich or Cruz end up taking the majority of delegates, and then we end up with an open convention. Does that sound crazy? It may, but I'm thinking, what would they say the RNC or the Republican Party have to lose by doing that?
Do you gentlemen think we're going to see a delegate battle or any of these kinds of sort of plans to take it away from Trump?
No, I think that's pretty locked up at this point.
Yeah, I mean, they did suspend their campaign, so technically they could bring him back. But I also have to say, I did notice that yesterday in West Virginia, Mr. Trump at a rally told people they didn't have to go, didn't vote for him. Stay home, you don't have to vote for me. Just have to vote in November. So you never know what'll happen. But I think with the actions of Senator Cruz and Governor Kasich just show that basically the path is cleared for him to be the nominee.
Well, I think if nothing else, this has been a good civics lesson for a lot of people, learning how the whole delegate process matches up with the popular vote during primaries and caucuses. Thanks for that call. Don, we could talk about this for the rest of the show, but I want to turn our attention to a few other kind of important stories this week, two of them dealing with Governor Hassan. And Jeff, let me start with you. We've talked a lot about this issue of solar power and net metering, and Governor Hassan finally signed a law expanding that.
Yes, this has been something that's been in kind of a focus of the legislature for much of the session. Under net metering, if you have a renewable energy system, mostly just solar system in your house or in your business, any extra energy, electricity you produce gets sold back to the utility. And what happened was this first cap, we had a cap on it. It would be 50 megawatts total. It's all the amount in the state that was generated, and that would this utility would be obligated to pay back for 50 megawatts. But it turns out in the last year or so, there's been a huge boom in the solar installation industry. There's been just a massive interest, and people have been putting more solar energy systems into their homes and other facilities. And cap of 50 megawatts, which had seemed so big back in the 90s when it first, you know, so high in the 90s when it was first imposed, was reached. And there have been attempts to expand it. They ended up doubling it, so they added another 50 megawatts to it. The governor signed that into law, and through various negotiations and stuff, what happened was that 40 of those megawatts basically go to residential users, mm-hmm. and 10 megawatts go to these much bigger installations, municipalities do it, and more commercial ones.
Now, yeah.
And what it turns out, it's been welcomed by the industry. There's people in the what they call the clean tech industry who are still would like to see no cap, which is what they have in various other states. But they're happy with this at this point. But the interesting thing is that even right after the bill's been signed, just signed the other day, each utility has a allocated part of that cap. Mm-hmm. In the Eversource area, which is by far the biggest utility in the state, they're almost at the cap for the commercial, for the larger scale production already, and it just went into law.
So they basically needed more space.
So they already have almost reached the amount of megawatts they can use for these larger commercial scale projects. And the argument is, well, this is the kind of stuff we're talking about, having renewable energy and not getting off fossil fuels and climate change and all that stuff. And already it seems that it's already at the cap for the commercial users. And all I can say is I would not be surprised if this comes up again next year.
It's interesting. We've been waiting for so long for solar to take off, yeah. and now they're running into these unintended consequences of actually figuring out a business model that works for people.
Yeah, because solar has taken off partly because of these things like net metering, also because the price of solar panels have plummeted in recent years. The installation has, and they have a new model of leasing them instead of having to pay for the installation. Yeah. So there's been a major increase in this and in the industry in New Hampshire, but what's enticing to people involves this net metering idea, and the rates being paid back. That's another complicated matter, but there's different levels of rates being paid to the generators.
Yeah, I think those leases have been the key to the exploding use of them. Trent, let me turn to you. We also this week had Governor Hassan's first veto of the year on a bill dealing with local building inspectors. What's going on there?
This one kind of flew under the radar for most of its life, but basically this would have limited the power of local building inspectors. It would have created a lower threshold. If anyone's ever done renovations or built in addition to their house, you have to go to the city or town, you have to get a permit, you have to explain to them what they're doing, you probably have to pay a fee. This would have required that you only need to provide, the quote was, a reasonably required information. So you don't have to – there's a lower threshold for what you have to provide to the building inspectors. And the governor's office, they thought that this would limit their power too much. The building inspectors, that is, and it would create a pretty vague standard for, what does that mean? What does reasonably
required
mean?
Yeah, it's really kind of a vague term, yeah.
Sure. So they vetoed it, and I'm not sure where the bill will go. I mean, I don't know where the issue will go next.
Well, it passed on by voice vote in both houses, so we're not quite sure if how many people are, actively supporting this or, it was The other thing is that the fire chiefs in the state and also Planners Association, people like that, they were not for this bill. And as Trent said, it was flying under the radar, and I think it caught a lot of people by surprise that it was even there. And it's really interesting that this is how the legislative process works. I guess that's why you have a governor who can veto things, because things get through. And I don't know if it did have as much of a fully aired debate as it maybe it required. As Trent puts it out there, would reasonably required. What does that mean? And you've seen that happen for other legislation, and that's debated and for quite a bit of time. But I don't think this was really as heavily vetted.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, another bill under consideration this week. This was a bill to allow employers to pay biweekly without state approval. Now, I didn't know you needed approval to get paid biweekly, but apparently you do.
You do need it. It's really interesting. We've been following this bill all session. And what happens is right now, I know many people say get paid biweekly. And how they get paid biweekly is that they have to ask the state for permission. A business has to ask for permission, get a permit from the state to pay biweekly. This bill would have said you don't need that permission. You could just pay people biweekly as you want, whenever you want to. But several advocates for especially lower wage workers were concerned about this bill, saying, people who live paycheck to paycheck, and by expanding the time between those paychecks, they would be affected. Labor Department was saying that, first of all, this is it by having this idea of having permission to do this biweekly, they also flag certain businesses that maybe aren't doing other things that they should be doing, like you know, paying maybe full workers' compensation insurance and those kind of matters, and maybe wage and hour violations. So what ended up the bill ended up basically dying because it was a 12-12 tie in the Senate, mm-hmm. and it's not clear what the next step is, but for now it's going to be the old rules.
You're still going to need the
you can
the
still need the permission from the state.
That's right. Trent, a couple other stories to get to before we run out of time. We've seen more this week on the water issues with PFOIA, that chemical that's used for, I guess, for nonstick pans and such. This is the Saint Gobain Performance Plastics. Now talk that they're actually going to get involved in designing water hookups for the affected residents to the municipal service.
Yeah, this is a big story that we've been following. You know, chemicals found in water in Merrimack, Litchfield, Manchester, and what the company said this week was that they were going to provide public water. So they're going to hook about 300 homes and businesses up in Litchfield up to the public water supply, which is being treated. And that's going to come at a cost of about $400,000. But they jumped in and said that they would do that in Litchfield. We're going to see what happens in Merrimack, and there's a very small community in Bedford that's also impacted. But we're going to see if they agree to do that. It seems like the company has really gone out of its way to save face here. They have sent the CEO here now two times. He's done interviews. He's come out and said, we will take responsibility for any problems that we caused. And this is a sign that they are, in fact, staying true to their word.
Yeah, Jeff?
Yeah, I was just going to say that the Department of Environmental Services told us we did a story on PFOA just recently, and they told us that they are – because this chemical is used in so many manufacturing processes, they are now doing an evaluation of different manufacturers around the state, trying to find out if they also use this chemical and seeing whether possibly that they also have a situation similar to what's happened in Merrimack. We know in Vermont, where they have there was a Saint Gobain plant in Bennington, in North Bennington. Some of the environmental regulators in Vermont did a similar study. They studied about 11 other sites, and so far, from what I understand, there's not really any results yet. But I think what's happened is that this really has raised this idea: what is this PFOA? We're learning what it is right now, but it is possible that there are other sites around the state where we could see something similar to this. It's not, you know, it might not be likely, but it's possible, and it has raised the concern of environmental regulators in the state.
I will say I was watching an infomercial, or I came upon an infomercial a few weeks ago, and it was for a nonstick pan, and it said PFOA free.
Yeah.
So I sort of said, oh, that's the connection
that's
right
exactly,
there.
Exactly, yeah.
One or two more stories we need to touch on and I can get a response from both you gentlemen on this. Passenger rail. This is an issue we've been talking about for some time now. It's gained some business momentum in the southern tier of the state. This week, a Senate committee basically refused to reinstate about $4 million in federal funds to even sort of plan this out. What's going on here, Jeff?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said in the southern part of the state, because I think for the rest of the state, it's not exactly a high priority. But if you talk to people in Manchester, Nashua in particular, these chambers of commerce, a lot of business leaders there are very, very much in favor of at least studying this. The money it comes from it's not state funds, it's federal money that's kind of just sitting there that's not being used for anything else, and the people behind this asking for this to take the $4 million and use it to study it, we're arguing that it's not coming out of the state taxpayers' dollars. Let's study this, but apparently the Senate committee just did not buy it, and I think it's their last best hope is to get in the Senate, because it just hasn't gotten anywhere this session, even though people in the southern part of the state, Trent will agree, they're very high in this idea, but you can't convince apparently other people around the state.
Yeah, Trent.
And that's the problem, is that there has been incredible pressure applied to politicians from business owners in Manchester and Nashua, but that's it,
yeah.
Right? No one else is talking about this, and everyone else is afraid that they're going to have to pay more money to cover the cost. Yeah. They don't think that there will be enough ridership to cover the cost. And so what you saw in a lot of Republicans in the Senate said, yes, it's $4 million. but it's not free money, right? It's federal money. It's still taxpayer dollars, and we're not going to take it for something that we don't think is feasible.
And the other argument is, well, let's at least study it to see if it is feasible. But, I mean, this is the whole idea of the planning. So it's, you know, they're at loggerheads. Let's put it that way.
I think we're going to be talking about this for a long time is my guess. Gentlemen, I want to ask you what you're going to be looking at next week. I wanted to mention real quickly, though, a brief note here that both Senators Gene Shaheen and Kelly Ayotte this week introduced a bill to create a special coin to honor Christopher McAuliffe on the 30th anniversary of the Challenger disaster. Proceeds would go to support programs to encourage science and technology and engineering among students. So with that said, what are you guys going to be looking at next week? Trent?
I'd recommend picking up the Sunday News. We're going to have a deep look at Donald Trump and the impact that he has had on the local Republican Party. I think it's going to be a really fascinating story.
Yeah, and actually, we have a really good piece coming up in our next issue next week on the drone industry in New Hampshire. Apparently, it's a budding industry in the state
and everywhere.
Yeah, but in particular, there's one business over on the seacoast that's builds these really impressive drones. They're all for commercial use, and people talking about maybe New Hampshire could become a drone center.
Yet another possible industry to develop, sure. Well, gentlemen, we are out of time, unfortunately. I know we're going to be continuing to watch all the political races and watching the state legislature as it wraps up over the next few weeks. And I'd like to thank you both. Jeff, it's always great to have you on the Roundup.
Great being on.
That's Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. And Trent, good to talk to you again, as always.
Thanks for having me.
That's Trent Spinner, executive editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. And I want you to remember, the conversation always continues online on Facebook and nhpr.org.